From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is unclear right now when or whether the next presidential debate will be held. President Trump said today he won't take part in the second debate next week because it was changed to a virtual town hall. He, of course, still has the coronavirus. But then the Trump campaign proposed postponing the last two debates to October 22nd and the 29th. The Biden campaign says in a statement today that if there's one on October 22nd, that should be the final debate. Last night, the vice presidential candidates were separated by plexiglass in their debate. Mike Pence and Kamala Harris sparred on the pandemic response, the Supreme Court, climate change, and the economy.
With four more years of growth
and
opportunity,
four more years
of President Donald Trump, 2021 is going to be the biggest economic year in the history of this country.
Thank you, Vice President Pence. Senator Harris?
Well, I mean, I thought we saw enough of it in last week's debate, but I think this is supposed to be a debate based on fact and truth. And the truth and the fact is Joe Biden has been very clear. He will not raise taxes on anybody who makes less than $400,000 a year.
He said he's going to repeal the Trump tax cuts.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
Our political strategist, join us now, Alice Stewart, Republican, Bill Press, a Democrat. I don't think we could have possibly picked a better cut to illustrate what happened last night in the debate than that one. But welcome to both of you. And Alice, let me start with you on this issue of the next debate. Will there be one? Should there be one? What's President Trump doing here?
Yes, there should be one. Will there be one? I hope so. Look, President Trump has recently been treated for COVID, and that's a reality. And we need to make sure that he is free and clear before we put him in contact with other people. And that's a valid concern. But what needs to happen, Jeremy, I've been involved in the debate conversations. The Commission on Presidential Debate needs to have these private conversations with both of the campaigns before they come out and make some sweeping changes, because now it has become in the public sphere and it just doesn't reflect well on the Trump campaign or the Biden campaign. I do think we absolutely need two more debates. The American people need to hear the contrast between these two candidates, but it needs to be done in a safe way, taking into consideration all of the COVID concerns, and it absolutely does need to happen.
Bill, what do you think?
I agree with Alice. All right. You never thought you'd hear me say that. No, I absolutely believe the American people deserve another debate, another two debates, and absolutely believe it has to be done safely. If someone is still contagious, he should not be in the position of perhaps infecting other people, maybe not the audience, but the people he's got to travel with, the people who protect him. Let the medical experts dictate how this should be. And by the way, I'm sure some people listening know this would not be, if it has to be virtual, I'd prefer, much prefer to be live. If it has to be virtual, it's not the first time. The third JFK and Richard Nixon debate, way back then when television was just starting, was a virtual debate. So no big deal.
Well, and it's interesting, just looking back at that, I've seen some pictures of that, and Nixon's in Los Angeles and JFK's in New York. Can you imagine the two candidates being in those cities this time around? But let's talk about last night's debate. Alice, what about last night's debate? Do you think it moved the needle at all? You know, you had critics accused Mike Pence of mansplaining over the two women on the stage for talking over them. Kamala Harris silenced Pence with "I'm speaking." There was the fly that landed on Pence's head. Did any of it change the situation with the race?
Look, Vice President Pence would have engaged the same demeanor if there were two men on there. So the stuff about him being disrespectful to women, I don't buy into any of that. Look, vice presidential debates, Jeremy, as you know, don't typically move the needle, but they do have the potential to cause distraction. And both of the candidates, they followed the three guidelines: do no harm, support the top of the ticket, and pass the commander-in-chief test. But what I think Pence did over Harris is that he was calm, he was in control, and she, with her laughing and appearing rattled, it didn't pose well for her. And so I think he came across as more in control, and certainly showed a stark contrast between a Trump-Pence ticket and the far-left policies of a Biden-Harris ticket.
Joe, what do you think?
This time I do not agree with Alice. Surprise, surprise. No, I thought Pence looked robotic. I think he looked sometimes flustered. He filibustered when he didn't know what to say. And I believe certainly that Kamala Harris more than held her own. And she scored, I thought, a big time on some big issues, on the, particularly on the coronavirus and the president's response to the coronavirus. And if anything, I agree it didn't change much, probably didn't change anything. But she did keep the focus of this campaign on the coronavirus, which is Biden's strongest point and Mike Pence's weakest point. But Jeremy, I have to add, anything that happened last night is now beyond the point. After Donald Trump this morning calls into Fox News, last night we saw Mike Pence, we saw two good people have a very civil debate about important issues facing this country. Mike Pence complimented Kamala Harris on the progress and the status that she has as the first woman of color on a national ticket. And yet this morning, Donald Trump called into Fox News. He called Kamala Harris a communist. He called her a socialist. He said she's beyond a socialist. He called her twice a monster. Seriously, I believe that is just, it's disgusting. It is racist. It is sexist. And is unworthy of the president of the United States. And by doing so, he totally stole Mike Pence's thunder. He had to get back into spotlight. And it's just unacceptable.
Today is a classic example of stepping on your own rake, where we had the opportunity to let Vice President Pence's debate performance really breathe, soak in, set in with the voters and the media, and really get some good earned media in support of the Trump ticket, which was extremely critical. And it was a good opportunity to let Mike Pence lead the headlines for at least half of a day. Unfortunately, obviously, that did not happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, give Mike Pence his moment. This was his moment. The president can't stand for anybody else to get in the spotlight, not even his running mate.
Yeah, if we could be a fly on the wall, we would make sure that didn't happen again.
Good. Perfect
Mike
way.
Mike Pence's head.
Perfect way for us to wrap up this conversation with a joke. Alice Stewart, Republican strategist, Bill Press, Democratic strategist. Always great to hear from both of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
For the sixth time this hurricane season, people on the Gulf Coast are either evacuating or bracing for another storm. This one is Hurricane Delta, which hit Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula yesterday. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Jeff, where is the hurricane today?
Good afternoon, Tanya. The hurricane is sitting in the Gulf of Mexico, the west central part of the Gulf of Mexico. It is strengthening, and Hurricane Delta is expected to make landfall in southwest and south central portions of Louisiana around this time tomorrow afternoon into early Friday evening. And it could become a major hurricane before it moves ashore. It's moving at around 14 miles per hour to the west northwest. It is currently expected to turn more to the north and once again landfall about 24 hours away.
Yeah, you talked about this a little bit, but all of these storms are different. Some do most of their damage with high winds, others with heavy rain that leads to flooding. What kind of storm is Delta, and what sort of damage could it do?
Yeah, every storm, as we always say, is very unique. This one is, a lot of folks have realized that this is potentially making landfall very close, within a few miles of where Hurricane Laura came ashore earlier this year in southwest Louisiana. But this is a different storm. It could be a lot larger in geographical size. It likely will be. It may not be exactly the same intensity as Laura, but its impacts are going to spread many more miles from its center, especially to the east and southeast, or east and northeast side. We're talking about Lafayette, Louisiana, Baton Rouge. Those areas are going to likely see more of an impact from this system than maybe they experienced with Laura. So remember, the storm surge is not always co-located with where the highest winds will be, and the surge with this one is going to also extend far to the east, even into portions of southern Mississippi and Alabama.
Can you tell us what's happening right now in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, what it looks like at this moment?
Well, they took a hit from a really strong hurricane, and it was strengthening as it moved in. So obviously, significant damage there on the northeast side of the peninsula. And of course, it did affect the resort communities and the island of Cozumel and the community of Cancun. We do know that those areas are prepared for storms like this. We just hope the same preparations are taking place now in southern portions of Louisiana. I know that there are significant traffic challenges right now on I-10 because of evacuations. Today is the day. So it's a good thing that we're seeing a lot of have evacuations taking place today because tropical storm conditions should be arriving in those areas during the morning hours tomorrow.
Jeff, Delta is the 25th named storm this season. I mean, we're in the Greek alphabet now. Is there any end in sight?
Well, the good news is we are on the downhill slope of hurricane season. This is around the time of year we have what's called a secondary peak, so it's not uncommon to see a storm like this come out of the Gulf. We had Michael a couple of years ago. Right now, there's no new development expected across the Atlantic Basin. We still have at least a few more weeks where there typically is some activity this time of year, so we'll keep an eye on that. Mm-hmm. But right now, conditions, fingers crossed, are calm behind Hurricane Delta. This would be the 10th cyclone, tropical storm or hurricane to make landfall this year in the U.S., and that would break a record when it occurs tomorrow evening. So hopefully we will not see any more activity in the tropics.
Yes. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
Our state is a dangerous place. That's how one Wisconsin health official is characterizing the spread of the coronavirus there. On Wednesday, Wisconsin reported more than 2,300 new cases and 16 deaths. That's up from 870 daily cases exactly 1 month ago. Among its responses, Wisconsin is planning to open a field hospital at the state fairgrounds outside of Milwaukee as early as next week. So let's bring in Dr. Nazia Safdar. She's the medical director of infection control at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Hospital. And Dr. Safdar, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
We want to find out more about that field hospital, but start by telling us how critical the situation is in your state and how overwhelmed are the hospitals.
You know, I think this is at the moment the biggest crisis that we're facing. In some respects, you know, it's predictable. We've seen how other states have handled it. But despite, you know, all the preparedness that one can do, you can't really ever be fully prepared for something like this. So health systems are having to activate their surge plans, think for creative ideas for how to take care of patients. But ultimately, no one has ever seen this the way that we're seeing it now. It concerns everyone.
Describe for us what you're seeing in your hospitals right now.
We're seeing a large number of patients coming in that are requiring medical care for COVID-19. We're seeing a large number of employees, because the community prevalence is so high, it is also expected that employee infections will increase, and that's exactly what we're seeing. And in general, I think as these cases go up, there's an increased sense of anxiety, of time pressure, of stress in the healthcare workforce.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this field hospital that's expected to open next week. How many patients will be diverted there, and will it provide the relief other hospitals need?
You know, I think it's a really welcome step. I think they'll probably start by having a few dozen go through the process and seeing how it works out with the ability to scale up as necessary. It will be a good decompression valve for health systems that are, despite their, you know, progressive planning, find themselves at a loss of what to do next.
Doctor, we know that other states have set up these field hospitals, and ultimately they weren't used or they were underused. Give us your sense of whether that would be a problem there.
I think, you know, in terms of timing, of course, we would never have wanted for us to be in this position, but you can't control everything. And given the timing, this is probably a better time to be than March, when we were still dealing with very high mortality rates. There was a great deal more uncertainty about effective ways to treat COVID-19. Now that supportive medical care is improved, we have some more therapeutics in our pocket that we can use for patients, I expect that the high, you know, increased mortality and the need for critical care is a little bit less. And that's where I think field hospitals come in, because they're not really equipped to provide critical ICU-level care, but they will be equipped to provide general medical care. So as long as the severity of illness doesn't rise dramatically, I feel the field hospital will get good use.
You mentioned the uptick in Wisconsin is in part due to employees, workers going back to work, but it's also being blamed on college and school reopenings. We know that the superintendent of one of the school districts there died of the disease yesterday, and that there have been outbreaks on your campus at UW-Madison. What's the path forward to stopping this current outbreak?
You know, I think while it's hard to tie it with certainty to any one inciting event, one telling fact is that up until very recently, the physical mobility of people in the state was approaching pre-COVID levels. So clearly, for whatever reason, typically it's because of fatigue. You know, people have been trying to do this for several months and they're running on fumes at this point. But obviously, we can't set the timeline for physical distancing and the need to really limit non-essential activities. And given the activity of the virus in the state at this point, this is exactly the time to double down, limit non-essential activities, wear a mask. Even if you didn't do it for the first 6 months of this pandemic, do it now. I don't think we should underestimate the point that it is vital at this time to preserve the capacity of the health system for us all to take care of patients with COVID-19 and bring them to a speedy recovery.
That's Dr. Nazia Safdar. She's the medical director of infection control at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Hospital. Doctor, thank you for talking with us and good luck.
Thank you very much.
The image of 20,000 empty black chairs set up near the White House for a memorial over the weekend was a striking reminder of just some of the many lives lost to COVID-19. Among the speakers at the event was Neha Kuspa of Baltimore, Maryland, who lost her father just 2 weeks ago. She spoke about his final moments alone in the hospital.
My dad was very anxious, scared, and gasping for air. Though I'm sure in those moments, Dad knew that his chances of survival were grim. We had no idea that that would be lights out for him forever.
And Neha Kuspa joins us now. Welcome and our condolences to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Neha, this memorial where you spoke of your father was organized by a group called COVID Survivors for Change. And, You know, there's been few national events like this to remember the more than 200,000 who have died in the U.S. from COVID-19. How important was it for you to participate?
It was very important for me. I just really wanted to really share Dad's story so that his, like I said in my speech, that his life didn't end just in those four walls by himself, that I was able to share with everyone what he went through, what that reality is for a lot of people who are hospitalized with COVID.
Well, let's talk about that reality and a little bit about your father, Ramesh. He died September 22nd after a six-week battle with COVID-19. He was only 67 years old, born in India, came to the U.S. when he was in his 20s, was a retired engineer, and very active and involved with your family. What do you want people to know about him and his experience with COVID-19?
Yeah. So, you know, my dad was very healthy. We brought our kids to play with him and he went on like 2-mile, 3-mile walks every day. So dad was just really starting to enjoy these years. And then this illness just hit him and it just took him with a vengeance.
Day 5 of his illness, he had slightly lower oxygen levels. You all called the ambulance because he was so scared. And then take us from there.
So Dad actually walked. We called the ambulance. He actually walked into the ambulance. We, you know, sat in the parking lot. My mom and I sat in the parking lot of the hospital he went to. And then he got admitted. And for Dad, you know, every COVID case is a little different. But Dad's decline was very slow and insidious. You know, my dad remained conscious for 16 days before his oxygen levels truly dropped so low that he needed to be on a ventilator. So it was torture for him and then torture for us to see his decline.
You speak with such authority, of course, because you are a great daughter, but you're also an outpatient doctor yourself, an essential worker.
Right.
How are you coping with losing your father on top of all of the other stresses that you're carrying? You're carrying a lot on your shoulders.
Yeah, I think I definitely have a lot of family support. I would say the whole experience was unique for me because actually I was still seeing my own patients. And at the same time, in the middle of the day, the attending would call me about my dad. And I would basically get an update and have like a 30-minute conversation. But that was basically the best way I could handle it, was continue my work and then still, you know, get the updates from the doctors about Dad.
That makes sense. How does it feel seeing our president, who's been diagnosed with COVID-19, sending messages that he's glad he's caught the virus and it's something that we can overcome?
Yeah. I think President Trump is very lucky that his course was not the same as my father's. And I'm glad. You know, I definitely wanted him to recover quickly. But his message is just not consistent with what our public health message should be. I think he made a comment, it shouldn't dominate people's lives. But in our daily life, it does in many ways. Our life is very different now than it was at the beginning of this year.
More specifically, the president has told the public not to be afraid. When you hear that, yeah, as a daughter of a man who has died from COVID-19 and as a healthcare professional, what goes through your mind?
It is a mixture of sadness and some anger, just because we are seeing the reality. Over 210,000 lives have been lost that did not need to be, my father included in that. And it's very hurtful to me, as well as to all the COVID victims' family members. It's insulting, I would say, to have him make that remark.
What will you say to the president if you had his ear?
Yeah, I would say, we need to stop this spread. We need to save lives so that they don't go through what my dad went through. So my plea would be that he take a stronger initiative. He fund our health department so we can do contact tracing more aggressively. That's just one element of it. Provide a unified message. Encourage employers to enforce this. I have several patients who call me and say, Dr. Cuspa, I'm fearful to go back to work because my employers are not enforcing social distancing in the workplace. Again, how are we going to do that if our leadership is not unified in that message?
Neha Cuspa of Baltimore, Maryland, talking with us after the death of her father, Ramesh, to COVID-19. Neha, thank you so much for sharing your father with us and our condolences to you.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us this platform as well. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
The Labor Department said today that another 840,000 Americans filed for federal unemployment benefits last week. Weekly jobless claims remain well above pre-pandemic levels as more layoffs are becoming permanent. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, what more can you tell us about today's report, and why are more of these job losses becoming permanent?
Well, like you said, big companies are filing for bankruptcy at a record pace, and smaller companies, the data is kind of hard to come by as far as how many have closed, but it's definitely in the tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of small businesses have closed. And even companies that are still going, there's just been these massive layoffs at places like Disney and the major airlines. And it's just really the simple reason that this virus continues to linger on and on and weigh on the economy, Jeremy, for a lot longer than people had originally believed.
Well, and it's making it all the more frustrating for so many people that there is no new relief package apparently coming from the federal government anytime soon, which means people's benefits could be dropping off dramatically. In some cases, that could mean just $5 a week for unemployment. What is the situation right now in terms of the benefits that jobless Americans are getting?
Well, it's poised to get alarmingly worse. One of the reasons that continuing claims for state benefits have actually fallen is that a lot of people have actually expired their state benefits. So they've moved on to the additional federal benefits that were passed as part of the CARES Act. And they can last as long as 13 weeks. But that program expires at the end of December, as does a program for people who were known as gig workers, who typically weren't eligible for unemployment benefits. So as you say, it really underscores the need for Congress to get some sort of agreement for these people, because a lot of people will be off the federal programs by the end of the year, millions of people, and not a good situation.
Well, and if you zoom out a little, we've got new data from the Federal Reserve looking at U.S. wealth over the first half of 2020, and it shows that the 50 richest Americans now hold as much wealth as the poorest half of the U.S. population. The pandemic clearly has widened an already pretty sizable wealth gap.
Yeah, it's an amazing statistic. And, you know, it's a simple reason. The very richest Americans That list is dominated by the founders of companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and so forth. And their wealth is basically a result of their stock holdings in their companies. And those companies have their share prices have done pretty well this year because they're either considered immune to the economic downturn or actually thriving as a result of it, a company like Amazon. So it really is widening out that wealth gap among the most rich in the country and the lower half, Jeremy.
Well, and just briefly, I mean, given that, it doesn't sound like most people are benefiting even when the stocks go up.
Yeah, I mean, the latest polls I've seen, more than half of Americans own stock. So it is a little bit of a buffer, but obviously not enough to counterbalance the other economic damage that's been done this year, for sure.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks as always.
Thank you.
On Monday, the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to begin hearings on the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. The Republican-controlled Senate is expected to confirm Judge Barrett. The question is when. Democrats complain the process is being rushed just weeks before an election, which millions have already voted in. As David Freudberg with the Humankind documentary series reports, this is just the latest chapter in a saga of contentious political battles involving the high court.
The week before Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, the Supreme Court was very much on President Donald Trump's mind.
In the recent past, many of our most treasured freedoms, including religious liberty, free speech, and the right to keep and bear arms, have been saved by a single vote on the United States Supreme Court.
With highly charged issues on the line, appointments to the high court are now intensely politicized. Hard to believe that not long ago, Supreme Court nominees, even with sharply differing philosophies, could be approved by the Senate with near unanimity. Justice Ginsburg, a liberal icon, was confirmed in 1993 by a vote of 96-3. 7 years earlier, the conservative lion Antonin Scalia was approved 98-0. But that spirit of relative cooperation is gone.
These are full-on wars now about who's going to be on the court.
Carl Hulse is chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times. His book, Confirmation Bias, chronicles the many judicial battles in recent decades.
Because of what's at stake in terms of what the courts have to decide now, immigration, health care, voting rights, environmental issues, just these really, really big hot-button issues.
The central question is whether the courts are now swept up in hyper-partisanship. Members of the Supreme Court are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. But their role in our system is to serve above the fray, not as politicians in robes. The complete independence of the courts, wrote Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, is particularly essential in a limited constitution. Here's Justice Elena Kagan on that.
It's an incredibly important thing for the court to guard, is this reputation of being fair, of being impartial, of being neutral, and of not being simply an extension of the terribly polarized political process and environment that we live in.
But raw polarization characterizes the current argument over filling Justice Ginsburg's seat. With Senate Republicans tightly controlling the process, the level of frustration by Democrats has reached a boiling point. Some are openly discussing ways to restructure the Supreme Court if they regain power in the coming election. It's not the first time this idea has been on the table.
What is my proposal?
This is President Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat, in 1937.
It is simply this. Whenever a judge or justice of any federal court has reached the age of 70 and does not avail himself of the opportunity to retire on a pension, a new member shall be appointed by the president then in office with the approval, as required by the Constitution, of the Senate of the United States.
Roosevelt's critics accused him of trying to stack the deck with as many as 6 new judges who would be more favorable to his New Deal policies. But the proposal went down to defeat in Congress. The modern-day judicial wars had their roots in the Watergate scandal. In October 1973, then-Solicitor General Robert Bork fired the Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox in what came to be known as the Saturday Night Massacre. That made Bork a lightning rod when in 1987, President Ronald Reagan nominated him to the court. Senator Edward Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, led the opposition.
Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, and the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens for whom the judiciary is and is often the only protector of the individual rights that are the heart of our democracy.
The aggressive pushback against Bork seemed to catch his allies in the Senate unprepared. In subsequent hearings, Bork, then an appeals court judge, defended his judicial philosophy.
How should a judge go about finding the law? The only legitimate way, in my opinion, is by attempting to discern what those who made the law intended. The intentions of the lawmakers govern, whether the lawmakers are the Congress of the United States, or whether they are those who ratified our Constitution and its various amendments.
Bork's nomination was ultimately defeated in the Senate. Then in 1991, Judge Clarence Thomas was nominated to the court. Law professor Anita Hill, who once worked for Thomas, accused him of sexual harassment, a charge he categorically denied. The all-male committee in a he-said-she-said drama repeatedly challenged Hill's motives. The hearings in which Thomas was confirmed were chaired by then-Senator Joe Biden, who voiced regrets in 2018.
Women should be believed. I believed Anita Hill. I said I believed Anita Hill. I voted against Clarence Thomas. I wish I could have protected her from the attacks that came at her, but I didn't know any way to do that.
Next up, the presidential election of 2000, a dizzying sequence of hanging chads and recounts in Florida, through the contest between Republican George W. Bush and Democrat Al Gore into doubt. Antonin Scalia was a justice on the Supreme Court.
Al Gore wanted the courts to decide it, so the only question in Bush versus Gore was whether the presidency would be decided by the Florida Supreme Court or by the United States Supreme Court. That was the only question, and that's not a hard one.
Voting 5-4, the court awarded the presidency to George W. Bush. Here's the New York Times' Carl Hulse again.
There was huge bitterness among Democrats following Bush v. Gore, and in 2001, when Bush took over and started to move to fill up the courts, Democrats thought these should be Gore judges being put on the court.
Justice Scalia died in February 2016, another presidential election year. On the closely divided court, it created a vacancy that could be filled by Democratic President Barack Obama. But in an unprecedented act, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refused to hold a hearing for Obama's nominee, Judge Merrick Garland.
It is a president's constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and it is the Senate's constitutional right to act as a check on a president and withhold its consent.
It had the effect of holding the seat open for 14 months until after President Trump took office and nominated Neil Gorsuch, who sits on the bench today. The judicial wars erupted again in the summer of 2018 when Trump nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the High Court. Christine Blasey Ford, a psychology professor from California, emerged as a witness with a startling allegation about what happened at a high school party she and Kavanaugh had attended.
I believed he was going to rape me. I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life.
Kavanaugh, then serving on the Federal Circuit Court in D.C., flatly denied the accusation.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
It was a deeply wrenching event for the Senate and the nation, and served to highlight the bitter divide over how judges are confirmed. Carl Hulse.
It still has left quite a bit of bad feelings amongst members of both parties. Democrats, after what happened with Garland, they just thought that they were being steamrolled. Republicans thought this was a horrendous effort by the Democrats to tar a man who they all think highly of. It was very vicious.
Now Judge Amy Coney Barrett will face nomination hearings scheduled to begin on Monday. With Republicans controlling the Senate, Democrats have little leverage. But both parties hope to use the outcome of this latest battle in the judicial wars to get voters to the polls. For Here and Now, I'm David Freudberg.
As the presidential election draws near, Facebook is attempting to crack down on misinformation flourishing on its site. The social media site says it will now ban all political ads after November 3rd in an effort to keep groups from manipulating the authentic outcome of the election. And on Tuesday, it banned all pages related to QAnon, a fringe conspiracy theory that claims that sex trafficking elites are plotting against President Trump. But many are wondering, what took Facebook so long? For more, let's bring in Brandi Zadrozny, an NBC reporter who's been covering QAnon closely. Welcome, Brandi.
Thanks.
So we know Facebook took down hundreds of groups related to QAnon this week. Many groups, like the Anti-Defamation League, had actually been calling on Facebook to do this for a really long time. What finally prompted Facebook to take this action?
It's difficult to say what resulted in the final complete ban, but they've had a lot of pressure to sort of crack down on QAnon content because QAnon content has led to some violent episodes in the real world. You know, attempted kidnapping, a woman was found with a car full of knives attempting to go get Joe Biden and, you know, take down the pedophile ring, and many, many other instances. So in August, they sort of took a step to say, okay, we're going to take down groups who actively represent QAnon and openly promote violence. And so they wiped out a bunch in August. And then, so now, you know, this week they took the added step and said, you know what, we're going to go further. We're going to take down all of the QAnon groups.
Okay, so QAnon has also been accused of co-opting other legitimate social movements. For example, using the hashtag Save Our Children to masquerade as a group who cares about stopping child sex trafficking as a way to draw in new followers. They've also been making inroads with parts of the health and wellness community. But based on this, how will the banning of them on Facebook actually work? How will the company be able to ensure they're not using more sophisticated tactics to continue on the site?
It's going to be a real challenge. I was in hundreds of QAnon groups just as part of my reporting, and almost every single one has been decimated by this ban. So what we'll see now is a lot of QAnon people who are really, really into it are going to move into smaller alternative social media platforms. But a great deal of them will probably just go back to their, you know, health and wellness, their yoga, their crunchy mom groups, and hopefully some of the worst parts of this conspiracy theory, the Save the Children ruse that you mentioned, will just sort of fade away. We really have to wait and see. But Facebook is really, they seem dedicated to this. And what we know is that there are a host of researchers and journalists and organizations like the ADL that you just mentioned who are really going to be watching what they do.
Can you give us a sense of just how many QAnon adherents there actually are? Some polls have put the figure at about 7%. Another researcher, though, Brian Schaffner with Tufts University, has actually pointed out that the QAnon conspiracy is so vast and convoluted, it could mean very different things to many different people, kind of to your point about where people will go now that they can't go to Facebook. He believes the true number of believers is probably lower, maybe 2%. What's your sense?
I'm probably more in the 2% bucket. I think, you know, QAnon is a conspiracy theory, but it's also sort of an umbrella conspiracy theory in which, you know, it also includes anti-maskers, COVID deniers, anti-vaxxers, you know, regular just sort of deep state Obamagate, you know, stuff that the president tweets would also be sort of under there. So I think it's a spectrum, but the true believers, the ones who are going to move on to those alternative platforms, that's really not that many people.
There's also been criticism of the media saying that we're basically reporting on QAnon like there's some new form of the Tea Party movement. But at the same time, we've never really seen a conspiracy theory quite like this before. I mean, for instance, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who is running for Congress, promoted QAnon theories. Your thoughts as someone who's been covering this conspiracy theory so closely as we come up on Election Day, is QAnon being taken too seriously or not seriously enough?
I think it's a complicated answer, but I do think, just personally, I think the QAnon movement is incredibly important. It does make up a lot of the most passionate base of the Republican Party. And so a lot of the disinformation campaigns we're seeing going on online that we like to talk so much about, a lot of those have been organized and spread by the QAnon movement. And so it's important to understand what they believe and how they operate. But it's also important that we don't just point a camera on all of these people and try to make a sideshow out of them, because although this conspiracy theory is as old as time, what's new here is the algorithms and the technology and the social media platforms that allow it to spread. So what Facebook has done now, this clampdown, is really an important moment in the QAnon story.
Randi Zadrozny, an NBC News reporter, we'll link you to her previous reporting on QAnon at hereandnow.org, and you can also find it at nbcnews.com. Brandi, as always, thank you so much for this conversation.
Appreciate it.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.